Hello, everyone. My name is Natalie Turvey. I'm president and executive director of the Canadian Journalism Foundation. It is my pleasure to welcome you to this CJFJ Talks live event, What Can Journalists Do That AI Can't? A timely look at the editorial, ethical, and economic considerations around AI in journalism. Thank you for joining us today. You made a great choice. If you enjoy these talks and would like to support the work of the CJF, you can donate now or at any time on the CJF website. Before we begin, I would like to acknowledge the Indigenous peoples of the lands that we are on today. While we meet on a virtual platform, we would like to take a moment to recognize the importance of the land that we each call home. The Canadian Journalism Foundation's office is situated on the traditional territory of many nations, including the Mississaugas of the Credit, the Anishinaabeg, the Chippewa, the Haudenosaunee, and the Wendat peoples, and we are privileged to live and work in these territories. The CJF is grateful to our exclusive JTalk series sponsor, TD Bank Group, for supporting another outstanding season of conversations about the future of journalism, and our thanks to our in-kind supporter, Cision. A reminder that our discussion today is an hour long, and you can still submit questions for our panel at any time via the tab on your screen. And if you'd like to tweet about today's conversation, our hashtag is CJFJTalks. The release of ChatGPT last year was a watershed moment in the world of work. Many in our industry believe journalism is on the cusp of a revolution as AI takes its place around the world in news gathering, production, and dissemination of information. So how is machine learning changing journalism, and what are the benefits and downside risks of using these technologies to produce news? How can news organizations use these tools transparently for the benefit of audiences? And what are the implications for restructuring and reducing roles in the newsroom? Our panel today represents a broad range of perspectives and expertise, and they will spend the next hour exploring the questions and issues around how AI is reshaping journalism. I am thrilled to introduce them to you today. Joining us from the Associated Press, where she is program manager for the AP Local News AI Initiative, please welcome Amy Reinhart. From Semaphore, executive editor Gina Chua is with us. From In These Times, we have labor reporter Hamilton Nolan. And joining us from the University of Quebec in Montreal, where he has been exploring the role of AI in Canadian journalism and teaching the next generation of journalists, please welcome Patrick White, former editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post. They are in conversation with Felix Simon. You are in great hands today as part of his work as a journalist, communication researcher, and doctoral student at the Oxford Internet Institute. Over the last year and a half, Felix has been speaking to more than 150 research journalists and experts to understand what AI will and won't mean for journalism and the news. It is an honor and a pleasure to have this panel with us today. Felix, to kick off the conversation, I will hand it over to you.
Thank you so much, Natalie. It's such a delight to see you all. It's such a delight to have this wonderful panel with me today. There's almost too much to talk about with this topic, and it will be impossible to do it justice in so many ways, but I promise we will try our best. And luckily, I have this fantastic cast of speakers and panelists with me who have deep experience in AI in the news in various ways. And I very much look forward to discussing this topic with all of them. And yeah, to get us started, it might actually help to clarify what we are talking about. So could I please get an opinion from my fellow speakers on what they see as sort of AI in a news context? Maybe starting with Gina, and then we can sort of kick it around.
Sure. I mean, obviously, we've used technology in newsrooms forever. And, you know, where the line between AI and anything else is, I think there's a saying that anything that can be done is machine learning. Anything you can't be done is artificial intelligence. So I think what we're really talking about is large language models, the things that power ChatGPT, GPT-4, Claude, Bard, Bing Chat, and so on, and sort of the our ability to manipulate language and to, you know, understand it. I think that's really kind of the area we're talking about here. But obviously, there's a lot more in terms of what, machine learning or neural networks can do.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Gina. Amy, what is AI to you? What have you learned from your work at the AP?
I think that it means different things depending on your newsroom size. So for AP, you know, it cuts across every department from HR to legal to news to business development, all of that. If I were in a small newsroom, it would mean something very different. It would mean that I might have an extra set of hands. If I didn't have a marketing team, I do now. So, I think the guidance maybe to our members and customers is slightly different depending on newsroom size than what it would be for a news operation that is global, that has 3,000 people working for it. So I think it holds enormous potential for both. It's just going to take a little bit longer for AP, I think, to really harness it across all the departments.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you so much. I mean, this was sort of broadly the international, the American perspective. Let's go to Canada and to Patrick. What is AI to you?
It's an assistant for journalists to take away routine reporting, basically, to cut through this crap I had to do at Reuters for 11 years to put XXLs into templates before the financial earnings of publicly listed companies. So in that regard, I see it as an assistant for journalists. It's not going to replace journalists. There are some layoffs here and there, but overall, it's an assistant to cut through routine reporting, financial statements of companies, weather reports, localized sports reporting, and very useful for election night results, for instance.
Thank you. And finally, to Hamilton, what's your view on this?
Yeah, I won't pretend to be a computer scientist, but I think what we're speaking about here today is products like ChatGPT and even illustration products like Midjourney and other things like that that can sort of, I think of it as products that can masquerade as doing the things that we do as journalists. It can write, it can make illustrations, it can superficially appear to do what we do, and I think it's really important for us to establish why it cannot do exactly what we do. And I hope we'll dig into that a little bit later on.
Wonderful. Yeah, thank you all for that sort of broad range of views. I mean, that's goes some way sort of towards illustrating how difficult it is in some ways to talk about this topic. Ask 10 people and they will give you 20 different opinions what AI means to them. But I think we sort of still coalesce as sort of a common center here. One thing that I find quite interesting is the question of what difference we now see with especially large language models and generative AI, because AI in many ways, as you all know, has been around in the news for a couple of years. It has been used in various shapes and forms of behind the scenes and not so obvious ways to audiences. And in many ways, ChatGPT, Google's Bard has changed that. But is that also something you all sort of see in sort of practical work? Would you really say that generative AI is the big difference that everyone sort of says it is?
Let me have a crack at that. I mean, you know, so I was at Reuters for many years and helped build tools there. And there's a lot of things that that AI systems have done. You know, mostly they've looked at data and been able, beyond just sort of being able to sort of add a number to a template, which I know the AP does as well, is to be able to look for patterns that humans don't have the time or, you know, don't have the patience to do and just sort of hunt around and find things and then alert a journalist to them. And you know, to the extent that those are interesting patterns, they can go out and look for it. The system we built at Reuters was a very crude language generator. It used templates and it just dropped the numbers in particular things. It would sort of randomize some of the words so that it didn't look, you know, the same all the time. The big difference with large language models is that their facility with language is amazing. It's really good. And as a result, they, you know, it can do a range of things. So at Semaphore, for example, we're using it to proof copy at the end of a story. You know, it's we don't take everything it tells us, but we use it, we run through and it finds deviations from AP style. It finds grammatical errors, spelling errors. It finds inconsistencies in facts. If, you know, you put in and say, you know, something is going down and hence it will increase, it will tell you that doesn't look right. And those are really powerful tools. The key issue, obviously, as we all know, is that they're all prone to hallucinations. They're not very good on facts. I don't think we should trust them with facts at this point, unless you want to really constrain the set of information that they have. where I think there's real potential, which is only beginning to be plumbed now, is the ability for it to create entirely new products that you could not do because you couldn't have enough people, you didn't have enough scale, you couldn't personalize stories to that extent. And I think that the existence of really effective large language models gives us the ability to really rethink some of what journalism is and how we can communicate better with communities and audiences.
So essentially sort of going from specific tool in a specific context, suddenly we have something that actually works across various contexts and can do much more. Anyone else who would like to respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, from, in 2014, AP did the business earnings reports where it was taking a spreadsheet and assigning if-then parameters. So if the price went up, then you use the word up. And if it went down, it went down. And that was almost 10 years ago. And at the time, it was like kind of like it was the shot heard around the world almost in that. And other news agencies followed suit. And when I arrived to AP in August of 2021, I was like, oh, I can't wait to, dig into AI. And people were like, oh, well, this is AI. I was like, what? Spreadsheets? Really? I mean, it just seemed so, I don't know, like on the rails, I guess. And when I started experimenting with ChatGPT, I was like, this is a totally different dimension that we have. I feel like that is the first delivery of the promise that everybody who's been so feverishly talking about AI that happened for me in that moment, where I actually felt, I had a felt sense of what everybody had been talking about that I had sort of just not been very impressed with, frankly. And, I've met with a lot of vendors who sell AI products. And again, over-promising, under-delivering, overcharging, like I just haven't been impressed. But that was a fundamentally different moment for me. And I don't know where you were when you first explored ChatGPT, but I remember where I was. And it's foundational.
It was quite an impressive moment. But of course, I think one thing we should explore here as well, and that's a good question for, I guess, both Hamilton and Patrick. So how do journalists feel about this? Because we've just heard from both Amy and Gina the sort of potential of this technology or set of technologies, what it can all do. And also they can do things that we usually associate with human intelligence or human abilities. And I sort of to Amy's questions, I very much remember where I first encountered ChatGPT. That was at my parents' kitchen table. And I was impressed. I was dazzled in many ways. And of course, this sort of sense of awe and magic can also tip over into fear and anxiety. And what's the sort of mood among journalists, Hamilton? What have you sort of heard? What kind of stories have you encountered?
Well, I see a fear of change in Canada, that's for sure. If you go back to 1995, when the World Wide Web started, the journalists were fearful. They thought it would be a fad. When I arrived at Reuters in London, Britain, in 97, there was one sole computer in the entire newsroom on Gray's Inn Road with some kind of Hotmail connection. So it gives you an idea. Social networks, a lot of news organization feared the change or did not properly understand the depth of the change that social networks would bring to journalism. And I think it's the same thing with AI. If you look at the survey that we did here in Canada with the top 13 news organizations at UQAM, we surveyed 13 news organizations in 2020 and 2021, and only two news organizations were really using it. The Canadian Press News Agency, which is the top wire service in Canada, they're using it like AP for sports results, localized content, Statistics Canada reports and election night results and stuff like that. And you have the Globe and Mail, which is the top national newspaper in Canada, which is now has been automating its own page with Sophie, its own made robot, and they're selling it worldwide. So if you look at Canada overall right now, it's a very marginal use of AI, and it's a fairly negative understanding as well, or negative perception of AI. If you look at ChatGPT itself, or GPT-4, I did an informal survey of all the top news organizations in Quebec here in the past 10 days. They're just not using it. They're still testing here and there, waiting to get testing the waters, basically. So it's still a marginal use overall right now in Canada.
Thank you, Patrick. Hamilton.
Yeah, I think there's clearly, it clearly has great potential as a tool for journalists to use, but it also has a lot of risk from a labor perspective. I'm a labor reporter. I've spoken to a lot of writers who kind of scoff at ChatGPT and say it's not that good of a writer. The stuff that it turns out is a little clunky. It's not that poetic. And, that may be the case, but that's not really the issue. From a labor perspective, the issue is that there are many, many employers in the media industry, especially once you get out of kind of the top, 20% of prestige publications that are very invested in quality, that will be happy to make the trade of a lower level quality product for a drastic cut in labor costs. And so there is no question in my mind that many, many employers are already going to use this as an opportunity to race to cut their labor costs, to replace journalists with AI. And that, I think, is something that we really need to think very carefully about. We need to realize that we haven't really made up an accepted set of journalism ethics around AI. We need to do that as an industry, and we need to delineate the very real ethical differences between human journalists and AI journalists to kind of get ahead of that race to the bottom.
Brilliant. Yeah. I mean, thank you, especially for pointing out the risks, because this is something I wanted to talk about next. And again, I'd be really curious to hear your views, because there are these risks, as with any technology, and it would be interesting to hear from you all, maybe again, starting with Gina, what do you see sort of as the biggest kind of risk or set of risks when it comes to this technology and its use in the news?
Yeah, I mean, so let me just riff a little bit on what Hamilton has said. I think that, those are certainly real issues, and they're, and the question often is going to be, sort of what is good enough at what price? And I think that he's absolutely right that there are people who are going to be trading off one thing for the other. I spoke to one of the AI people. I can't remember which company now, and he sort of said, I said, there's a lot of people who aren't, whose core work is going to go away, and his answer was, it's real drudgery, and they don't want to do that. I said they don't want to do that, but it does pay the bills, and we have to think a bit about that. And I think that's not a journalism problem; that's a societal wide issue. Of what you do when essentially an entire class of knowledge workers goes away. And I think that that's a real issue. And I think that the complaints about it not being good enough and so on are all real, except it will get better very quickly. If you look at the difference between GPT-3, 3.5, and 4, you see how fast things have moved. I don't think so much generally of the issues of the sort of the people at the top of their game being outcompeted, because I think they'll continue to outcompete a machine. I do think that the people who are slightly better than a machine, the above average writers, if you like, are suddenly going to have to compete with a lot of people who are slightly below average writers, whose work is going to be improved by technology. I think the key thing is that we've spent a lot of time sort of critiquing ChatGPT and GPT-4 and so on as tools of creating journalism. And that's not really what it is. And that's not how we should think about them. They are large language models. They are not fact machines. They are not verification machines. They can't do any of that. In fact, they're terrible at that. They can't even sort of, in effect, continue a conversation well. They remember the context, but you can ask it the same thing several times and it will give you different answers. I think if we focus on their skills, which is to say that they're really good at language and think about what they can do as a language model, that's the best use we have. But the broader question you say, you talk about in terms of, what are the risks? I think there are huge risks, right? There's risks because we don't understand what they do and what they are. And as a result, we start using them as search engines, which is a real problem. We start using them to generate content, as some news organizations have done, with pretty horrific results. And of course, there's always the real risk of disinformation and the ability to create sort of a lot of very plausible sounding information the creation of made up links, made up articles, I think that all will proliferate. So I think we have to think about all of those things. But frankly, they're all broader questions than journalism questions. I think they are large societal questions.
Anyone, thank you, Gina. Does anyone want to add to that?
Yeah, I would say, I think that a good, you know, one good way for us to try to keep AI in the sort of box of tool as opposed to content creator or journalist itself is to think about the fact that accountability is a fundamental part of journalism, right? If you are a journalist and you write a story, you're accountable for the story. You are able to be questioned about the story. You are able to explain how you made the choices in the story, why the story is fair. AI can't do that fundamentally, as Gina eloquently just spoke about. You know, AI is not that thing, and it cannot do that. And I think it's also crucial to point out, because I've already seen some publications undertaking the practice of having AI produce content and then having a human editor look at it and then publishing it and saying, well, we had a human look it over. Well, an editor cannot interrogate AI in a way that gives it accountability, you know, because it's not a human. So I think keeping that front and center is very important and a useful thing for us to think about when we do sort of build the widely accepted ethical practices that are going to have to come up pretty quick around AI.
Let's briefly talk about this in the context of especially local news. And I know that Amy has conducted a lot of work on this over the past 2 years with Ernest Kung, her colleague. What's sort of your take on these putting in place these guardrails and sort of thinking about these questions from especially the local perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is going to be a very creative moment and a very useful moment for local newsrooms. They haven't really had any favors delivered to them lately, and I think this might be one of them. And I think the best way to see a tool like ChatGPT, which really just puts a nice public face, a useful face on this technology, is to put an existing article in there and ask it to summarize it. Ask it to create a Twitter thread from it. Ask it to create a Facebook post. Ask it to do A/B headline testing. Like there's endless ways that you could actually make it somewhat of an assistant. And when we speak to 3 people newsrooms, 4 people newsrooms, that would be significant for them to be able to have that feedback loop in the absence of a full-time editor that some of them are lacking. So I think, this is going to be helpful for them, I think, in a way that maybe national and global newsrooms maybe can't take advantage of, because as Hamilton said, there's just no pushback. You can't go back and be like, where did you find this information? But I think other ways that journalists cannot be replaced is their contact list, their way to analyze, their way to put things together, and the historical knowledge of a place or a topic. It just can't be matched. Maybe one day it will, but we're not there yet. So any journalist who's nervous, I think you've got some time left.
That's very good to hear. And I'm pretty sure lots of people will be very happy to hear this. Could I quickly ask people around the sort of question of efficiency increases, because that's one thing I see come up again and again in interviews where people say, well, one of the big hopes for AI more broadly, and especially large language models, is it will increase efficiencies and it will allow journalists to do more of the things they like and few of the things they don't like. The question is that actually true? Is that something you have experienced in practice where you would say, is it actually happening? Is it part of the hype? What's your sort of take on this question? I know that there's not probably a proper answer to it, but I'd be curious to hear your sort of personal experiences.
I'll jump in. I mean, I think there's no question that technology brings changes, right? And in many cases, they are efficiency changes. And so, you know, being able to add in Excel as a spreadsheet is far better than, you know, counting on my fingers and writing it on a piece of paper. And so obviously that's a tool for efficiency. You know, being able to search and pass through a lot of information is a level of efficiency. And so when you think of large language models, you know, again, that, you know, as Amy has pointed out, just, you know, doing a few things that would ordinarily require a bunch of people to do, you know, brings some sort of efficiency. And so again, for us, just proofreading at the end, it isn't just the question of efficiency there, it's actually better at proofreading. than we are, because your eyes get tired and this will find stuff, you know, that you can't otherwise find. I mean, spell check in you know, on your Word document is pretty impressive, much as I originally hated it. But I really do think that we are often taking the wrong, we're often starting from the wrong perspective. We tend to look at how technology helps us do our current job better. And there are transformative technologies that don't, right? I mean, when a car comes along, you don't say, you know, is it better than a horse? It's better than a horse in some respects. It goes longer distances. It doesn't get tired. It doesn't shit all over the road, pardon my French. And a horse is really good because when you're about to go off a cliff, a horse stops and a car doesn't. So they both have advantages. They're just different. You have to decide what you want to optimize for. And I think that the key thing that we haven't really applied imagination to is how you use technology to create things that are completely different. When TV first came out, you know, the BBC, I think, famously had people sit in front of a screen with a tuxedo and read the news because that's you know, it was radio on, you know, that you could see. I look at large language models and I wonder, why can't we start making interrogative news? Tell me what happened today. Well, this, tell me more. No, tell me about the next story. And because you have the ability to generate language at scale, you can customize that. Why don't we customize stories a little bit more so that we can give you information about the place that you're in or the market portfolio that you have or the player that you're most interested in? I think there's a whole host of things we can do, and we need to ask ourselves those questions. How can we make journalism better for our readers and consumers and audiences and communities? Because that's who we're serving, right? We're not serving ourselves, we're serving other people, and we need to figure out what the tools are, how the tools can help us serve them better.
Yeah, that's a lovely distinction, especially because it basically takes two things apart, which is efficiency on the one hand, which is basically improving things you already do, and effectiveness on the other hand, where it's about achieving something in the first place. And I think that's sort of often we sort of mix the two together. And in some ways, AI could potentially actually help us to do more good journalism, which is ultimately what news organizations want to do. Could I get anyone else to sort of respond to Gina? Maybe Patrick.
Yeah, if you look at tools that can transcribe video and long audio interviews into text, that's very useful for journalists, for all newsrooms. I look at the one that AFP, Agence France-Presse, developed, Transcriber. I know they keep it in-house only, but these tools are just amazing for our journalism students. And if you say that AI is can do 15% of tasks in a newsroom, the rest, I think that's going to be very important is the focus on added value content by real human being, real journalists. We're going to spend more time in the field, more in-depth reporting, more investigative journalism. Overall, if you look at Canada in the past 10 years, the number of investigative journalists across the country has been increasing dramatically. More focus now on journalism of solutions. Data journalism is going very well in Canada right now as well. It's being developed dramatically as well. So overall, if you focus on added value content, which is the basis of human journalism, I think you're going to be able to keep all those jobs while having a good assistant to help create content and not journalism.
Brilliant, thank you. Let's move on to a different topic. I think one thing we should really talk about in this context is the tech dependency, which often or basically happens with AI. And in some ways, it's sort of been shown through lots of research that AI development and deployment is very strongly dependent on big platform businesses and companies like Microsoft, AWS, and Google. Even with a lot of the current startups, take OpenAI, for example, they are, yes, nominally independent, but still dependent in many other ways on these platform companies, be that for funding or for cloud computing resources to train their models and make AI possible in the first place. My question now to all panelists is, how do you see this in the context of AI's new sort of use in the news? Is that a problem? Is it not a problem? Could it be a problem at some point? What's your take on this? And whoever wants to start, maybe Hamilton first.
Well, I'm not a tech reporter, but I do think that, you know, to the extent that existing major, I mean, we see what the tech industry has done in the context of corporate America, in the context of the media industry. The media industry is dwarfed by the tech industry now. The tech industry essentially controls the media in an economic sense, at least. And so to the extent that existing big tech companies are going to be empowered by AI, it's just going to exacerbate that. And we will keep and continue moving on down the road to the domination of a small number of tech platforms, which don't have the same direct incentives to do good journalism that pure media companies do always.
Thank you. Anyone wants to respond to that?
Well, the large players are going to benefit overall, that's for sure. If you look at who's using AI right now, it's only the major players. It's the four wire services, Bloomberg, AFP, AP Reuters. It's the Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal, top newspapers, the New York Times, Washington Post. And they're the ones who are going to benefit because they do have the money, they have the expertise, they can train the staff as well. I pay tribute to what AP is doing as well with training the newsrooms across the US. So it's all about if you have the financial means to proceed with this AI revolution or not.
It's kind of interesting because I'm hoping and I'm seeing some of the stirrings of a little bit of that reversal of that trend. And I agree with you completely, Patrick, that, you know, there was a time when scale really, really mattered. And you could see that in the Journalism Awards where, you know, one newsroom would put, you know, 40 people on, which is bigger than, you know, some other newsrooms, and you just couldn't do that. I've seen in the latest round of I run a data journalism award on the side, and you can see that there's smaller and smaller newsrooms coming through, partly because I think the tools have become easier for people to use, and you no longer need to have as much expertise. You don't need that 5-person team now. You can get it done with 2 people and so on. So I think some of it is democratizing potentially, but I go back to Hamilton's point, which is we are on a path of great dependency on large technology companies, right? Whether or not they're Google, Amazon, or anybody else, but fundamentally there isn't a newsroom, and I know because I've tried for even really large news organizations to be able to build that kind of technology, and the kind of money that you see that goes, you know, that OpenAI has raised. Or Anthropic, or any of these companies, you know, it's just not competitive. And you can do your best you can, but you're not going to be doing anything as good. And so I think we're in sort of a question of what happens when or if you can't get access to those tools, when you have to sort of buy them. Imagine if, you know, whatever Microsoft Word cost you $100,000 per person, you know, how would you be able to run a newsroom? And luckily it doesn't. Or what happens if the core tools to create the product that you want, to reach the people that you want, all cost too much, or for whatever reason aren't available to you? I think we have some real questions about those levels of dependency and what we do. And I think the other thing too is, you know, as the democratization comes, and again, to echo one of the points that Hamilton makes, which is, you know, you've seen tech companies, and well, not tech companies, other companies, do all sorts of things. They've sort of picked apart the news bundle, right? So I don't look at the weather in the newspaper anymore. I used to all the time. Now I don't, obviously I don't need to, and just go to Weather Underground or something. I don't need to look at the box scores. In fact, I don't know any newspapers that still have box scores on sports, if I care about sports, which I don't. But there's a zillion places you can go to. And I think what will happen is that a lot of that information and a lot of the civic information that newspapers and newsrooms used to produce gets, you know, gets disintermediated and moved out. And I'm not sure that destroys business models, which is an issue. But two, also some of that information does have a public service goal. And I'm not sure that the people providing it always have that public service mentality that I think news organizers. I'm not suggesting that we go back to a world where you can only get sports scores in newspapers, but I am saying that this is something that is, and again, it's a societal issue that we need to look at.
Thank you. Amy, do you have any further thoughts on this?
Well, I think, like as I mentioned before, I do think the next year or two we'll all look back and be like, weren't those fun days? But especially for local newsrooms, I do think the technology is so much more accessible than it's ever been. Now I know a lot of local newsrooms like hire the student who goes to college and they wait for them to come back for winter break in order to make an update to their website. Like those days are kind of gone, you know, and I hope anyway. And also too, they're, you know, these six technology companies are vying to be number one. And so they've really cut their rates. So for example, the editor and technologist at Lost Coast Outpost, which is in Northern California, you know, he's running GPT-3 to summarize meeting agendas. He also has it summarized as a sea shanty and Scooby-Doo just to make things fun. But, you know, he does that every month. It costs him about $10 to do so. You know, in a year or two, once the dust has settled a bit on who's going to be the most generative of all the AIs, you know, those prices might increase. And again, that dependency on big tech is bounces right back, or at least is more glaringly obvious when your bill goes up. So I do think we'll see that in the years to come. But for right now, experiment.
Probably also not something that just the news industry can solve on its own. I mean, there is something like regulators who will have to look at this carefully and consider what options they might want to consider in sort of response to this.
I mean, American regulators have not really had our backs through the dot-com era.
Unfortunately, but then again, there's something called the European Union. Maybe they will do something and show
we're
something.
We're counting on you.
We'll try. Given that we don't have all that much time left, could I ask all of you what you think is the broader impact of society, basically, as news organizations change through AI? And we've seen lots of examples tonight, basically, where AI is doing something to the way the news gets produced and distributed. It changes all these things in some small and some big ways. What do you think will that ultimately mean for societies? Because, of course, the news is part of societies and can't be sort of untangled from that broader whole. It's a big question, I know, but any volunteers?
Oh, what the hell? I'll do it.
Thank you, Gina.
I mean, you're welcome. So look, I think there's a set of different issues, right? I think that the first thing to really think about is the economic impact, which isn't really sort of the news impact per se, except in an indirect way. But as we've all seen, you know, as the advertising business has gone away, as news organizations have been disintermediated, you know, the business models have collapsed for a lot of organizations. Jobs have gone away, but leaving aside, you know, the fact that we're all, you know, we'd all like to have more journalists, the truth is that the key question is what's happened to the information ecosystem. And it's rather horribly impacted. And so I think that's the first thing, which is business models which fund journalism content more broadly. I think that's one of the key questions, what will happen as, you know, as the technology improves and large language models and you know image generators really sort of come up. I think there's a whole set of economic disruption. That's sort of a fairly key one to look at. I think the flip side of that is, you know, the technologies can allow, you know, smaller newsrooms to flourish, can allow you know, news deserts to get repopulated. But I think it runs in two directions. I do worry that the big broader implications of a fairly large disruption across essentially the information economy is coming. And, you know, maybe it's good, maybe it's bad. I don't know. I don't know that enough people are studying it, enough people are thinking about it, and enough people are thinking about regulations. And I get come back to Hamilton, I keep quoting, you know, just the notion of, you know, ethics and codes of conduct, I think are the sorts of things we should really be debating now. Before it all comes up upon us in a rush and we're trying to make decisions in a hurry, which is never a good idea.
And I would just jump in, and that was, I thought, very well said by Gina in terms of the promise and the peril of this technology, and have to give a plug to unions in this context, because the reality is, like, when we can have very thoughtful and well-intentioned discussions like we're having now among journalists who are very serious and thinking very hard about how to use these technologies in a promising and healthy way. But in terms of enforceable codes of conduct on this, the reality is that the only real mechanism for that is going to be in media union contracts at media companies. If we're going to sit around and wait for the government to effectively regulate this, you know, as Amy mentioned, like we already lost there. So every media union that I know of in America, and I'm sure in Canada as well, is talking about this. And every media union contract that's coming up in the next 3 years needs to have a section in there about how AI is to be used in the newsrooms. And if any of you watching this have not unionized your newsroom yet, here's a good reason to do so.
Yeah, you're going to need limitations in those upcoming collective agreements. And if you look at the regulation angle for Canada, the Broadcasting Act of 1991 has never been updated. It's going to be updated this year by the House of Commons of Canada. But 1991 is 4 or 5 years before the arrival of the World Wide Web, and Canada right now is acting without even regulating the overall internet. So it's going to take, don't count on the governments to regulate this. And you're right about what you're going to put in the collective agreement. Are you going to limit the use of AI for only routine works in a news desk? That's one of the things to look at, and also experiment as much as possible in the meantime to see what you can do with it.
Amy, any final thoughts on this?
No, they all said it well.
Perfect. Okay. Thank you so much for all your brilliant points. I will now move to audience questions, of which we have a ton. So I'm not sure if we will be able to answer all of them, but we will try our best. And let's maybe start with Pragati, who asks if any of you see any legal and ethical issues. Is it okay to use slash train AI models on copyrighted info? Who would like to answer that question? I see Gina laughing, or Amy. Okay, Amy, you go.
I don't necessarily want to answer the question, but it's on the top of everybody's mind. You know, we AP produces 3,000 photos a day, 2,000 articles a day. Yeah, we have a vested interest in making sure that the people and the organizations that use our material are compensating people who are going into war zones, who are asking hard questions to people in power. And it costs money to do that. And to be able to borrow this information and use it to train models and not even point back to the source, it's really problematic. And then in addition to all of that, replacing search where it doesn't direct you to those articles, it's like we're getting a 1-2 punch with that, where we're not getting compensated and we're not getting people pointed back to our material. So I don't think AP is alone in the concern, but you know, the question is, you know, do you get litigious or what? And that is still up to debate. Because it's not an easy thing to proceed in. You know, many substantial cases have sided with the tech platform, saying that what has been created is decidedly different and that this organization is helping society. So y'all can determine how much it's helping, but those that's the legal precedent on it so far. And so it's still to be debated. And even collectively, I think we were talking earlier about Barry Diller's call for the industry to gather together at Semaphore's event recently. So, I don't know. You'd have to get all those newsrooms to agree too. So.
Which is going to be challenging. Next question. It's sort of slightly related, where Priyarak asks, who will be copyright owner of a news article written by AI sourced from different publications? So basically, we come to the question of what do news organizations sort of want from each other when it comes to this? Who would like to have a go at that? Gina?
Well,
yes.
Well, look, it's a straight up legal question, right? I mean, I think the general feeling on copyright law, I'm not a lawyer, although I did want to go to law school, is that, you know, if it's transformative enough, then obviously it is your own. And there's issues of fair use and so on. So if you take bits and pieces and you aggregate and you write it in your own words, you know, facts are not copyrightable by and large, but expressions are. And so you you know, there is that, right? I think it's really a question of how transformed it is. And I suppose there's an open part of law which says, you know, if a machine transforms it, how transformative is it? And I think, like, that's not really settled law by a long shot, because we haven't had machines who could transform things with the level of fidelity and quality that we've had until now. So I look forward to whoever can. I'm also not confident we'll have a whole bunch of new laws, but I think judges are going to have a lot of interesting cases in front of them.
That's the one thing AI is creating for all of us, more work, and now the judges are in on the game as well. A question from Darcy. She asks, do you know if any newsrooms that are actively using AI like ChatGPT to write articles, and is it or how is it disclosed to readers? And let's maybe go to Hamilton.
Yes, CNET was doing that in the US and not very well. They eventually, I think, ended that. I mean, it was definitely a case where they got out ahead of themselves. They started publishing AI stories directly to their website and came to find out they were full of errors and things like that. And it was a little bit of a fiasco. But other publications like BuzzFeed have announced certain uses of AI, not quite that direct. But you know, it does sort of point to the fact that as soon as the technology was even close to ready, publications rushed forward to use it. So it's a good illustration of like how vital it is for us to figure this out fast.
Great, thank you. Now a question from Maggie. She says, Gina mentioned the risks that come with large language models. Do we have best practices for managing or mitigating these risks? What might those be? And maybe a question for both Gina and then for Patrick as well.
And I've written this several times now. These are not fact machines. They look like they're fact machines. They look like they talk to you, but they are in fact, I think one of the words was stochastic parrots. They're very good autocomplete things, and they're very good. And so, you know, again, if you want to ask a language question, it's very good at language, and you should use it for all sorts of things. I mean, I used it to say, you know, take this article and rewrite it in the form of a Reuters article, in the form of a New York Times article, in the form of a Fox News article, and it hit it beautifully every time. There's no errors introduced, grammatically correct, all of those things were good. But of course, the moment you say, you know, tell me something about myself, it just goes haywire, because it's searching for information that it does not know how to verify. You can ask it to add two numbers, and I assure you that, you know, you may get the right answer, but there's no way you would know it was correct. And I've done those experiments too. So I think what are the guidelines? The guidelines, you have to know what it does. You can't think that there's a screen and there's someone sitting on the other side typing away your answers. You have to know what the technology is. You don't ask Excel to sing you a song, and you don't ask your TV set to cook your dinner. Just, you know, be clear what it does.
Thank you, Gina. Patrick, anything to add to that?
Well, the ethical debate is there. That's why there's so much push right now to put a pause on this AI revolution. Obviously, it's not going to happen. That's why you have ethical AI booming here in Montreal with all these centers powered by Google and other companies. And this is why a lot of people are pushing for responsible AI. But at the same thing, you've got to be practical. If you look at ChatGPT, for instance, the first version that came out last November was not connected to the live web. It's now connected to the live web with the new updates in beta mode. The former version was only the data set was ending in October or September 2021. So that was an issue as well. You got to take that into account if you are in the news business. I mean, ChatGPT is not going to produce journalism right now. It can produce some content. A lot of evergreen content, for instance, but at the same time, the human being is always going to be there at the end of the line to revise the content. It's the same thing with Google Translation premium content being translated that the Canadian Press News Agency, they're translating AP and Canadian Press content from English to French for the French service La Presse Canadienne here in Quebec. Well, it's never going to be perfect. So that's why you have top-notch editors going over all these translations. which will never be perfect, especially in other languages than English.
Thank you, Patrick. Just briefly, if anyone, of course, wants to chip in on any of these questions, please do so. But the next one, and I think that's a proper Amy Reinhardt question. What is the single best investment the small newsroom can make when it comes to AI tools?
What's the single best list?
Best investment a small newsroom can make when it comes to AI tools.
Oh, AI tools. Let's see here. I mean, I think some of this technology, maybe the best investment is someone who's a developer and not not a very high-end developer, somebody who's maybe even a tinkerer who can use some of the APIs that, for instance, OpenAI has for Whisper, for ChatGPT, and try and experiment and see what works in your newsroom. I think that the cost and the barrier to entry has never been lower, and the knowledge that you have to have in order to code. I mean, ChatGPT is pretty good at writing code too. I mean, it has one of the demonstrations, I think, was on was about creating it on your own website from instructions. So I think local newsrooms could and should experiment and to dive in with a tool like ChatGPT or Bard to see. Those tools are free for now and yield interesting results that should never go direct to publish.
Brilliant. Another question from Natasha. She asks, what is the responsibility of journalists to teach digital literacy when it comes to AI, if any? I see Gina sort of exhaling. I mean, it's a broad question. Who wants to tackle it?
Well, civic education is booming in Canada. Media civic education in primary schools, high schools. That's part of it, I would say, overall, to try to explain to the general public the impact and the negative and positive sides of AI. But I see it as part of a global, worldwide approach to civic education, to media and information, the fight against disinformation and fake news. This could be part of those courses given at the primary and high school level, and maybe at some point to the college. And the reform of the journalism programs in universities worldwide.
You know, I worry about that part the most, Patrick, is the colleges that are trying to train tomorrow's journalists. They have such a hard time pivoting and expanding curriculum and adjusting to what's happening. And let's face it, a lot of the professors are maybe haven't been in the field for a few years. And they're still very great at what they do, but like, can they meet this moment? I really hope that universities will try and adjust and adopt the new vocabulary that their graduates are going to have to know.
Yeah, that's a question from Mark, which sort of directly relates to this. How would you all reassure current journalism school students who already regret majoring in journalism at high levels as they indebt themselves to study journalism? That's sort of very philosophical on some levels. Anyone who wants to take that, Hamilton, maybe.
I don't know how I can make you feel better about going in journalism. You know, I will say, as has been discussed here, AI can't report. It can't do reporting. It can't find stuff out. You know, it can write 10,000 words about last night's volleyball game, but it can't go to the game and it can't watch the game and it can't know what happened in the game. So, I mean, the human element of journalism is not going away ever, I don't think. Whether or not it's a good idea financially to become a journalist, I'll cross my fingers for you.
Great, thank you. Let me have a look. There's so many good questions. It's really, really difficult to make a pick. Maybe let's go with this one. So we have Mihak who asks, ChatGPT is writing college essays and producing music and art. These were uniquely human pursuits till date, and AI will only get better. Does this moment of disruption feel different, or is it just another addition to major disruptions of the past, such as TV and World Wide Web and social media? That's, again, a very broad question, but quite an interesting one. We would like to have a go at it.
I think it's a deeply disruptive moment. I think we're at a phase where you know, to the extent, you know, again, to some extent, it doesn't matter whether you consider it imitative or whether you consider it original, but it is a, you know, technology is at a point where it very effectively mimics human behavior on a bunch of things, including some things that you might otherwise have considered creative. And I think that the societal adjustment to that is going to be huge. And again, it's not a journalism question per se. It's a music issue. It's you know, writing jingles. It's, you know, it's writing advertising copy. It's writing a novel. It's, you know, where are the boundaries on that? What will it do well? What will it do better than some people? I genuinely don't know. And, you know, to sort of say that the human race has always evolved to new tools, I think is one way to say that. And another way is to say, like, we've never had this sudden level of change of what we believe to be core to humans, which is our brains. And this, you know, and this feels very, very close to being a very big step that we've never seen before.
Yeah, it definitely feels the same. We're almost over time, so maybe one final response to this, and then unfortunately I will have to wrap up this session. But who else would like to have a go?
Just that I'm very interested in this evolution. I wish it was moving slightly slower. you know, GPT-4 was released, and then I saw it trend on GPT-5 on Twitter, and I was like, can you give us a break? Like, we need a break to pause, to process what is happening. And I think if there's a disconnect or why people maybe feel uneasy is because it's just one rollout after another, and it's hard to keep up. And I'm interested, so I can't even imagine the people who are somewhat interested that it just, you feel overwhelmed by it. But, you know, again, it's what's happening right now, so we'll just have to adjust.
It's certainly an onslaught, and we try our best to sort of stay on top of it. Thank you so much, everyone. Thanks to all the great audience members who asked really, really interesting questions. I'm very sorry that we couldn't get through all of them. There's still at least 20 in my document here in front of me, which I wasn't able to ask, but hopefully you will get answers to them at some point. You can always try ChatGPT or Bart and see what their response might be like. Thanks to all my wonderful panelists and the Canadian Journalism Foundation for hosting this talk. It was such a pleasure to convene you all in this different space and talk about this. And I hope to have lots of other conversations with you about this topic. And yeah, AI is not going to go away. So the miracle is out of the box. And now it's up to us what we make of it. And we'll see. The future is going to be exciting. I think that much is for sure. So thank you very much all, and have a lovely evening, afternoon, wherever you are, and goodbye from Oxford.